And now, conversation piece. Sue McGregor visits Cumbria to talk to the scientist Sir Fred Hoyle.
Sir Fred, these days we think of you, of course, as a distinguished astrophysicist, but I believe you started off your professional life in science as a mathematician, and I wonder if maths was something that interested you very much as a small child.
Yes, I think I learnt the basic processes of mathematics, which are concerned with numbers, probably at the age of 2½, that sort of time, although, of course, I wouldn't claim to be able to remember any distinct details as far back as that. The first thing I remember of my childhood was of being intrigued by a big grandfather clock that we had in the living room, and by the fact that people were always looking at this clock and making funny remarks about the time, such as 3:20. And no number that I knew had the word past in it. I knew about 20 and I knew about 3, but I didn't know about 3:20. When I was sent to bed at night, I used to shout downstairs in the hope of attracting some attention, and the question I found that was most likely to be answered was, "What's the time?" And on one occasion I shouted this down, and my memory now comes in. The answer was 7:20. And I puzzled, where was a number called 7:20? And I couldn't think of it. So suddenly it flashed through my mind that it was really two numbers, 20 and 7, and that maybe one number referred to one hand on the clock and the other number referred to the other hand.
Is that what you've been concerned with all your life ever since, more or less?
That was my first bit of research. The following morning, I found this was true. I must have been about 3½ at the time. And that is my first real memory of childhood, finding out that this was true and the thrill of making a bit of a discovery for the first time.
When did you first consciously become interested in the stars?
It was about 8. And we used to play outside at night in the autumn as the nights drew in. And I recall one particularly brilliant night, which must have been either in late September or in October, and there's a tremendous blaze of stars across the sky, because in those days there's nothing much in the way of city lights, and in any case I lived out in the country.
You were in Yorkshire?
Yes. And I remember seeing these great things up there, and looking rather the way you can see them today out in a remote part of the American desert, for example, and thinking to myself, well, somehow I'm going to find out what those things are. And I think that was the beginning.
You must have been a pretty advanced little boy for your age, and I imagine that you found school rather boring, and perhaps some of your fellow pupils found you rather annoying too, if you were that much brighter than them.
I don't think, because I always mucked in when there was a fight going on or something of that sort, and I always took part in the games. I wasn't particularly brilliant at games, and that always gives the other lads the feeling that there's no difference between you. It's certainly true that for a long time I found it difficult to get on terms with my teachers, because I've been so used to thinking of my own problems that I found the drill, the rather slow drill of organized classes, very irksome when I was young.
What did you do instead?
Well, the sort of thing is, I get interested in my own problem, and then I get into trouble with the teacher, then I get fed up with the teacher, and I get fed up with the whole school system and want to go off on my own and do something.
Which tended to be what sort of thing? When you went away on your own?
Oh, I would go into the local mills and watch how cloth was made on the looms, or I would go to the locks on the Leeds to Liverpool Canal and watch the marvellous way in which you get boats through the locks by means of sluice gates. This is absolutely marvellous, the way nobody had to work. They just allowed the water to come in and go out, and the boats rose and they fell. I'd watch that sort of thing for hours, and I'm sure it was much more educative than anything I would have learnt had I been in school.
Rather a fascinating thing for you to watch, obviously, but elementary science, that was. You went up to Cambridge and you spent the best part of 40 years closely connected with Cambridge University as a scientist. I imagine that in those 40 years, man's knowledge of the universe must have advanced quite tremendously.
Yes, it's developed quite remarkably in fine detail. A good example would be the gramophone. When I was young, when just had those things you wound up with a horn attached and a tinkly sound. Whereas nowadays, with the best techniques, you can really get something that's better than the original almost. That kind of thing has come on enormously. If you look to fundamentals, well, I'm not sure that one can truly say that the second half of the 20th century is going to exceed the first half. The lads around the first part of the century, people like Planck, Einstein, what they did really runs very deep still. And aside from in biology, I'm not sure that we quite match up to that. Although when it comes to these remarkable applications like computers and so on, there's no doubt that what has been done there in the field of applications is quite inordinately brilliant.
Hasn't our knowledge, though, of outer space increased enormously?
Well, it's increased a lot in its detail, but, you know, the discovery of the expansion of the universe was, around 1936? It's quite a while back. And that, one might say, was the biggest discovery in astronomy of the century. And although, once again, the details of X-rays, infrared astronomy, and so forth is terrific in what it means technically. I don't think we can pat ourselves on the back and say we've really done any better than the former generation did. What was done between 1900 and 1940 was absolutely marvelous, and I think you might say that in the sense that we can compete at all with those 40 years, we've done pretty well.
Throughout your academic life, Sir Fred, you've never been afraid to popularise science and to tell the rest of us who don't understand it very well what some of the discoveries have been through the means of science fiction. And one of the books that you wrote was called The Black Cloud, which I think made use of one of your own theories to make it interesting, the theory about life beginning in outer space.
That's right. Well, there was some quite serious work in the early 40s directed towards that end, which didn't seem in the 50s as though it was going to come to anything. It's been revived now as a serious matter with very great force, but for a while it looked as though it was going into limbo, and the best thing to do with it was to fictionalize it at that point. But now I probably would not do so, because I think it's too near reality to put into fiction. It's really a question of whether there are molecules, complex molecules, which are associations of atoms out in space, and these associations becoming the precursors of life. Well, we know pretty definitely now that they're there in great quantity, whereas in the 1950s this seemed a rather remote possibility. In fact, the astronomical establishment was swearing one uphill and downhill that they were not there during those particular years.
So your theory is, this theory is, that life on our planet came to us from outer space. How?
Well, I think it just arrived very conveniently in our atmosphere. Our atmosphere provides a soft landing for literally, I would think, billions of cells that arrived here from outside. It's absolutely right to provide for safe arrival for the cells of the size that nature has them, living cells. They are just right to be able to enter the atmosphere of a planet like our own. They would be present, I think, in enormous quantity in the material from which the solar system formed. On its outside, the temperature would be rather low, wouldn't destroy living forms. The quantities of material would probably be of a planetary order. They would be terrific compared to anything we have on the Earth at the moment. And we on this planet, I think, just got a little sample of that, probably a tiny sample. Most of the material, I would think, is still locked up, frozen on the cool outside of the solar system.
So presumably we're not the only people who've been pollinated in this way, according to your theory. There could be life on many planets within our universe, other planets, life like ours?
I think you can put it this way. Whenever there is a niche in the universe, then I think you'll find life there. And it need not be a niche like the Earth. It's quite likely that life has a far broader spectrum of possibilities than anything we see on the Earth. So wherever there is any means of supporting it, I think you'll find it. That would be my opinion.
You've never really been one of the scientific establishment, have you, Sir Fred, despite being a fellow of the Royal Society? You've always been considered a bit of a maverick as a scientist. Is that something you'd not disagree with?
If you keep it to scientific issues, I wouldn't disagree with it. I've always gone my own way, formed my own problems. I don't try to be a maverick just for the sake of being a maverick, but it should be pretty obvious that if you're looking for interesting problems, things which haven't already been solved, you've got to be a maverick, because if the orthodox views are right, the problems are already solved. So it's clear as that. So I don't choose this for preference. It's just that I don't have any desire or pleasure in being a part of a sort of popular bandwagon where nothing particularly is happening. Everybody holds the same view and nothing changes from Monday to Friday. That doesn't interest me very much. It's just the way I was when I was a school kid. I want to walk into the mills, see the mills. I want to see the canal and the boats in the locks. And in a similar way, I want to follow the things that I find interesting. And that's the real reason.
Has this meant, though, that you've been denied, for instance, money for grants to follow your theories about life beginning in outer space? You've actually had applications for grants turned down, haven't you, by the Science Research Council?
Well, this is almost inevitable, because when it comes to the award of public money, it all gets, or almost all gets, awarded to those projects that everybody is agreed about, which by my definition are the uninteresting ones. So I personally don't really think that one can fund exciting research through public organisations. That is my opinion. Now, especially after I've been outside the system myself for 10 years, almost 10 years, and can look at it from a distance, I think it's a poor way to do things.
Yes, you left Cambridge University just under 10 years ago, at a time when you were a comparatively young man as an academic, as a professor. Was this a tough decision to take for you? And why did you leave? Was it because you disagreed with some of your fellow academics, or because you disagreed with the Cambridge hierarchy?
Not at all, because I disagreed with the university as such, with the government of the university. I always got on very well indeed, because politically, I'm a rather right-wing sort of person, and I've never had any trouble with dealing with political authorities. It was in dealing with my scientific peers that where the troubles arose. And here you expect to be in disagreement. It's quite a natural thing, and nobody really worries too much about it. But there are certain lines that are drawn. I mean, if you have certain responsibilities, you have to do certain things, you have to get money for various projects, you have to help certain of your colleagues in particular ways with their research. It is generally agreed that other people shouldn't interfere with you beyond a certain point. As I say, there are lines that can be defined. And in my view, these lines were seriously crossed by some of my colleagues in a way that I unfortunately could not prevent. And it was at that point that I decided, well, enough's enough.
But it must have been hard for you to actually take the decision to leave a university you'd been associated with as a student and as a professor for so many years. Wasn't it
hard? Yes, I would agree, but I had certain warnings that this might happen. It didn't all happen in a minute or a month or a year, and one turns it over in one mind, and slowly one arrives at a decision, and you cross the bridge, and there it is. I've learnt from my experience of walking on hills that once you make a decision, let it be a decision. Don't look backwards in life.
You've not attached yourself permanently to any other university. Were you tempted to leave Britain at any point, perhaps to go to the States?
I've always been tempted by the situation in the United States, because technically it's very good. On the other hand, on the whole, I like the climate, shall I say, which just sounds an amazing thing to say. In this country, I like the hills, I like the wild country, and well, I arrived at a compromise decision. I go to the States now for various periods of the year, and the rest of the time I'm in the wild country, so that suits me down to the ground.
One of your own great interests now, I know, and it's a worldwide interest, of course, is the energy crisis, as it's commonly called, and where we're going to get our energy from in the future. Now, the United Kingdom has a considerable nuclear industry, and at one point I gather that we were actually world leaders in the peaceful application of nuclear power. Now that seems not to be so. There's a lot of controversy surrounding nuclear power and how safe it is. You feel that we must go along the nuclear road?
Well, there's no question at all. It's absolutely for certain. The loss of our lead, if you like to put it that way, on the nuclear side, I don't think is due to what one might call social opposition, these people marching in the streets. I don't think that has done very much at all. I think that's just a waste of time. It's rather been the wrong prognostications of the economists who, through the 1960s, simply couldn't understand that the price of coal and oil was going to change. They just misled the country, and so things that should have been done, that it was absolutely paramount to do in the 60s, were not done. That is the main cause, and we're going to suffer very, very heavily for it, I would think, in the 80s and 90s.
Are you saying that the right kind of nuclear reactors are not being built in this country?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the emphasis on building nuclear reactors was weakened because people thought it was going to be more expensive to produce energy that way at a time when coal and oil were cheap. Now that coal and oil have become dear and are going to get much dearer still, we would have done better to have ploughed ahead firmly with the projects that were started so well in the 1950s and early 1960s, and not to take any notice at all of the economists who are, I think, perpetually misleading governments and people generally.
Of course, the anti-nuclear lobby, and it's a very strong one, feels that nuclear power has by no means yet been proved to be a cheap source of power, and in fact we're mad to go on pouring millions more money into an unproved source of cheap power.
Well, I would question all of what you've said. Firstly, I don't know how strong it is, because it's never been voted on, and even in a country like Sweden, where it was very, very much stronger than in this country, the voting didn't show any very great strength. And on the question of the safety side, there's nothing safer than nuclear energy. I live tolerably close to Windscale, and I would judge the danger of living where I do now for a whole lifetime is less than the danger of my making a single trip into the neighbouring town of Keswick in my car. That is the order of the dangers. There's absolutely no danger from civil nuclear energy, if by danger one means risks at the level that we take in a routine fashion in our daily lives, like driving on the road.
Do you say that despite the leakages that have undoubtedly occurred at Windscale?
The leakages are nothing. They're just minute quantities of radiation that harm no one. There is as much radiation in the walls of this room. People don't seem to understand that radioactivity is everywhere, that the detectors for radioactivity are exceedingly sensitive, and the fact that a minute trace gets away from where one doesn't want it to be is not important, because that minute trace is maybe no more than a percent of what is there already in the rocks and the soil. To put it this way, if one got all the world's energy from nuclear reactors, and one did the quite unwise thing of dumping all the waste into the sea, nobody would ever do that, but if one did that, and one continued to do it for 1 million years, the radioactivity of seawater at the end of the day would be no greater than the radioactivity of the same quantity of soil that you dig up from your garden. The stuff is everywhere, and the amount that Windscale do is trivial.
The anti-nuclear lobby again would say we simply don't know. Nuclear energy isn't old enough for us to know what the effect will be on subsequent generations of people of even these minute leakages.
Well, we know what the effect of the natural radioactivity, the stuff that's coming out of the hills, that's coming out of the floor and so forth, and we know that this is not being important. The people in Cornwall, down near Land's End, for example, get 2 or 3 times as much radioactivity as the rest of the population, and many hundreds of times more than one would ever get from Windscale. The people who live in the granite houses of Aberdeen also get comparatively large quantities of radioactivity, and no one has ever been able to see that this has damaged them in any way, and nobody is suggesting that Cornwall be evacuated or that one destroys all the houses in Aberdeen. I think this is complete hysteria, nonsense, all this talk. And the real issue is that the people who are engaging in it simply don't know technically what they're talking about. This is the real problem. If one is familiar with the technicalities of nuclear physics, then it just seems fantastic. And I can't quite understand why these people involve themselves in it. Why is it so important to them? I can see that one very well might be concerned about a nuclear war, which would be a serious thing, but the nuclear energy for civil purposes is not.
If we're not to depend on oil in the future, is there not an alternative to depending on nuclear energy in what some people call the soft options, water power, sun, wind power? Could we not sink a lot of money into those?
Well, we could sink a lot of money into them, but one will get nothing out of sinking the money into them. They're useless. If there's anything in these things at all, it would have happened already, because there's nothing original about wind power. It's been here since the Middle Ages. There's nothing original about solar energy. Biology uses it all the time, growing wood and so forth. All these things have been on the cards. Man, in a sense, has lived on them for thousands of years. He knows all about them. The technologies, for the most part, are not new. And if there was anything in them, they would have happened already.
You sound, Sir Fred, rather a pessimistic man at this moment about the way the world is going. And yet, living here as you do in Cumbria, on a beautiful moor, on a sunny day like today, don't you feel that there's hope for mankind as well?
Oh, there's hope for mankind if one looks at the problem in a broad sense. Mankind is a very tough animal. Man is a very tough animal, and woman too. And they've come through very hard times. They've come through half a dozen or more ice ages in very difficult circumstances. There's no question that man is going to come through. What is not going to come through, I think, and this is where my pessimism comes in, is the particular kind of society in which we find ourselves living. I think this society has become very fossilized in its structure. It has very little give and take in it. It can be upset by minor fluctuations of a percent or two in the various economies. I think it's grown into a kind of monstrous dinosaur of a thing that is approaching extinction rather quickly. I think if you can project yourself 10,000 years into the future, I think that is an exciting projection. I think great things are going to happen. We're going to see a lot. I can't believe that the experiment of intelligence on the Earth is anywhere near the end of the road. I think rather it's just at the beginning. I think what we've got ourselves is a restricted social situation which is not going to persist any more than the serfdom of the Middle Ages persisted. But I don't see it as having any more importance for the longer term evolution of man than indeed the medieval structure of society had. I think it's all going to go, but it's going to be replaced by the general onward sweep of mankind.
On a shorter time scale, what's life going to be like for your grandchildren, of whom I know you're extremely fond, and their grandchildren?
Well, one hopes that somehow they'll be able to find a way through. As I say, the people are very tough. I remember the case, a well-authenticated case of a boy of 11 who was crossing the United States when his parents were killed in an Indian raid, and he managed to get his three-year-old sister through to California. That's typical of what humans can do when they're really called to face up to difficulties. And I think that many people will come through the difficulties ahead, and one hopes that one's own line, as you say, one's own grandchild will be among those that come through, and all one can do is equip them as well as possible to that end, I think.
So you feel your mission is still to impart knowledge, scientific knowledge?
Yes, I can't see there's anything better that I could do. If there was, then I'd probably be doing it.
Sir Fred Hoyle, thank you very much indeed.
Sir Fred Hoyle was talking to Sue McGregor. Conversation piece is produced in Manchester by Gillian Hush.